The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
This is Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours, Dave Willingham, and Tim Johnson. We'll be back next week. Tonight, we're going to be speaking with Jerry Ibalarosa-Tennell, who's one of the leaders of the Let's Talk workshop on race and racism coming up in Bellingham in February 11th. But first, we want to share with you some of the audio from the town hall that our representatives Chris Litton and Representative Jeff Morris had last night. They were speaking as representatives of the 40th Legislative District.
Good evening and welcome to this 40th Legislative District live telephone town hall with your state representatives, Christine Litton and Jeff Morris. The 40th Legislative District represents San Juan and part of Skagit and Whatcom counties, including Anacortes, Burlington, and part of Bellingham and Mount Vernon. My name is Lily, and I'll be your host tonight. Now I'll turn it over to your lawmakers for some opening remarks.
Good evening, everybody. This is Chris Litton. Thanks for joining us tonight and for being eager to interact with us as your state lawmakers. I'm not going to take too much time on my introductions because we're really interested in hearing from you, but I did want to mention a few things about my work in Olympia. As many of you know, I serve as the finance chair on the House side, and that involves a lot of discussions about how we can make our tax system fair for working and middle-class families. One area I'm very interested in is how we can reduce taxes for small businesses to help them employ more people and offer better wages and benefits. I've introduced some new business tax reform proposal that will exempt 80% of our small businesses for paying business and occupation tax. And I'm really very excited about that, and hopefully it can move forward to help, you know, grow our economies, particularly in our small communities, and help our small businesses thrive. I'm also working on a proposal to reduce our property taxes. I'm excited about some of the work that we've done in the capital budget, which we just passed this past week, to build and modernize our schools in Mount Vernon, Bellingham, and Anacortes, and many other projects that I'm sure Representative Morris will have some he'll want to talk to you about. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff Morris.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Really excited to talk to you and hear your concerns and your questions here tonight. I'm going to touch on just a few subjects. I chair the Technology and Economic Development Committee, where we have jurisdiction over those two subjects, plus all of energy and telecommunications as well. Some of the bills you may have heard that I'm working on that are kind of the fun ones that we've been doing have been, we're going through a huge transformation in the electricity sector. Every time you've bought a new appliance since the recession, it uses half the energy of what you replaced it with. And we're trying to move forward with a lower carbon footprint as well. And getting that, those policies right to do that is really important. I've got another bill that's going to make us what they call us one of the ZEV states, that's ZEV for zero emission vehicles. Right now there's a handful of other states that belong to that category, and they get the electric cars first. And we're often, even though we're second in per capita electric car consumption here in Washington State, we often don't see most of the models until up to 1 to 3 years after they're introduced. I've got another bill that is a right to repair your broken cell phones and tablets that a lot of industry is trying to make it so you can't get those repaired, and we're trying to make sure that you have a right to fix those and to keep them in service and out of the waste stream. Another one I'm trying to encourage investment here in the new 5G, the fifth generation cell phone technology. Chris mentioned the capital budget, which we're really happy to pass out of the House and put on the governor's desk last week. And there was $106 million for the 40th District. It was a really big capital budget, so we're finally, even though it was late by several months, we're happy to pass that. But that gave the money to fund the Blanchard Mountain transfer, as well as the local YMCA Mount Vernon schools in Lopez, Bellingham, CM High School, and Mount Vernon all received funding from that budget. One of the things I've been trying to do is to get a bill passed that passed the House last week to name the Blanchard Forest, which has never been named. It's just called the Blanchard Forest because it's on Blanchard Mountain, the Harriet Spinell Forest, to honor her service and her work trying to protect the Chuckanut Mountain Ridge for multiple uses and multiple recreational experiences for generations to come. Just to mention a few things, if you want to talk more about them as we go into the questions, Chris and I have both been expressing our dissatisfaction about some of the interruptions to service to the San Juan Islands with our ferry service. Even though Chris worked with me to get the new funding bill passed to get our new ferries constructed, the super-class ferries, which are the Yakima and the Elwha that service the San Juans, are getting to be some of the oldest boats in the fleet. It seems like they're breaking down, you know, literally every other week. So we're communicating about trying to get better retasking of boats to have less interruption of service. We look forward to your questions. Those are a few topics we're working on that you may or may not have read about in social media or online. It's really both of our pleasures to serve you down here, and we love looking forward to these teletown hall meetings because we really think, we're not saying this just because you're on the phone, but it's really a great district to represent because you let us work on such interesting projects that a lot of other districts don't. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. If you are just joining us, this is a telephone town hall with your 40th Legislative District representatives, Christine Litton and Jeff Morris. We're going to go with Steve, who has a question about ferries to Guaymas. Hi, Steve.
Yes, thank you for taking the question. The Guaymas Island Ferry is up for replacement, and Skagit County's first and yet only application for money to replace that ferry is with the CRAB board, their ferry replacement plan, which mandates a establishment of a ferry taxing district, and Skagit County has chosen to narrow that definition to Guaymas Island only. Doesn't raise enough money, and it's very divisive. There's a Senate bill, 6354, that removes that requirement. Could you see your way to support that as it goes into the House?
Yeah, this is Jeff Morris. I'm going to take that question. As you probably know, I grew up on Guaymas Island, so I'm really familiar with the current, not only the current ferry, but the Elmar that it replaced. Yeah, so certainly if that bill comes over, I've ran some bills in the past that would have required at least a public vote from the citizens of Guaymas if there was an attempt to create a district-only taxing district. That's something I've not supported. We don't charge people driving up to Alger for the new overpass we're building on Old Highway 99 from Cook Road up to Alger, even though really only the people who live up in that area benefit from it the most. So it's not, you know, we tend to not discriminate on transportation just because only, you know, one geographic area people, you know, benefit from a piece of public infrastructure. In the past, I've ran bills in the House that would have clarified that if the district only included people who were serviced by the infrastructure, they're either by petition or by the county commissioners electing to do it voluntarily, there would have to be a public vote on it. That's something I think is the least that should be happening, but we'd be happy to support the Senate bill if it comes over to the House.
All right. Thank you. We're going to go with Louise, who has a question about TERS 1 and getting a COLA.
Yes, hello. And, yes, I'm a retired teacher, and I'm very interested in our Plan 1 COLA that I believe is still in House Appropriations, and we're hoping to get it voted out of there. We are one of the only retirement group that hasn't had a COLA for 8 years, and all the other retirement plans are having one every year. So I'm wondering if Kristen would support moving it out of committee, and would she support us vote for it?
Yeah, Louise, thanks for your question. And, yeah, that is in appropriations right now, and I know the fiscal note is very high. I also know that the prime sponsor, Lori Dolan, and many of us are very interested in trying to figure out what we can do with this. As many of you know, my father-in-law is a PERS 1 retired school teacher, so I look across the Thanksgiving table and at Christmas time, and he asked me this exact question. So we're trying to figure out a way that how to move forward with this. I have not gotten an update today. I know that we talked about it quite a bit last week, and there is a strong desire to do this. We're just trying to figure out how to pay for it.
All right, thank you. We are going to go with Eric, who has a question about net neutrality.
Good evening, and I realize this is also an issue at the national level with pretty widespread support, but I also wanted to know from either one of you if you are sponsoring or you are co-sponsoring any statewide legislation that would protect enhance net neutrality statewide.
Hi, thanks. This is Jeff Morris. I'm going to take that question. First of all, yes, there is legislation that we are considering in the House. I suspect there is in the Senate, but I'll have to double-check that. But there's two bills the committee that I chair, I scheduled and we voted out two bills last Thursday on net neutrality, and they were identical. One was sponsored by Democrat Drew Hansen, and the other was sponsored by Norma Smith, Republican. And there's been a lot of collaboration, and it's the privacy issue around this has really been a bipartisan issue. So we moved both bills out, but it's probably going to be the Drew Hansen bill that moves forward. And what we're basically doing is saying in state law, you know, that the neutral treatment of content providers over the gateway into your home is going to stay that way. Otherwise, the state attorney general could bring a suit against those companies for not treating the marketplace fairly and openly. We have got another bill, too, that we're going to vote out tomorrow that's related to net neutrality. It really deals with the privacy provisions they did away with that would keep the people that provide you Internet service like, Xfinity, Comcast, Frontier, I know there's other providers out there, from basically monetizing or selling and snooping at, you know, where you're surfing on the web and selling that to third-party vendors. And so that bill would keep them from doing that. We're going to vote that out tomorrow.
Yeah, and Eric, this is Chris. I'm actually a co-sponsor on Representative Hansen's bill and appreciate his work, and Representative Morris is on this. So I'm hoping we can move forward with something this session.
All right, thank you. We're going to go with Tom, who has a question about ferries.
Yes, Representative Morris, you've done a great job with the ferry system because you're knowledgeable about it. You lived out in the islands. And so one question that I've got is, would it be possible to look into using the Alaska Ferry Terminal in Bellingham that the port of Bellingham now has, expand that a little bit and maybe one or two more landings? And use it in either emergency uses to service to the island, like when the ferry shut down completely here a few days ago from that accident, or maybe even use it on a regular basis. Would you consider doing that? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. That's actually a great question. It kind of reminded me about some of the work we've done over the years looking at the Bellingham Ferry Terminal. You may or may not remember when we actually had state-owned passenger ferries. And at one point, we looked at providing passenger-only service to the Bellingham Terminal from Orca, so via inter-island route. In Bellingham, because what we found is that a lot of the shopping activity that takes place for people that actually live in the islands at the time, and this was a few years ago, maybe before Costco was in Burlington, used to drive to Bellingham to do a lot of their big box shopping and so forth, but there's a lot of folks actually taking classes up at Western Washington University, and there's a lot of connections to the Fairhaven area out in the islands as well. So we looked at actually doing that. It was feasible. It was actually a shorter route, but, you know, even as just a backup for something, instead of having boats stacked up out in Rosario Strait waiting to get obstruction down the terminal, having that ready to go as a backup is just an excellent idea. I'll take it up with the ferry service tomorrow because they're probably gone for the day now, but we'll certainly look into it. You know, as far as we're getting new boats into service, at some point, I hope we have enough boats where we can start looking at expanding service because, you know, we have an inadequate level of service now. You know, the boats we're replacing are just trying to take the average age of our fleet from, you know, 40 years down to hopefully 20 at some point. And so we don't have the number of mechanical failures we're having. But if we can keep a boat construction process going, looking at expanding services to Bellingham with extra ferry service would certainly be possible.
We're going to go with Mona, who has a question about insurance or lack of insurance in Skagit. Hi, Mona.
Yes. Hello. Yeah, I just am very concerned with the fact that since Obamacare started, which I tried to see if I could qualify for. I do not qualify to get it, and the only carrier for insurance in Skagit County is Kaiser Permanente, and you can't get any other insurance other than that, and my rate has gone up from like $400 in 2016 to now in 2018. Last year it was $604. It is now going to be $710 for less coverage, higher deductible, and that is the only opportunity I have for getting health insurance.
Yeah, this is Chris. That's a legitimate concern, and I know that we have Representative Eileen Cody out of our caucus who's been trying to ensure coverage that is available everywhere in Washington, including what we call our bear counties, to try to stabilize the health care market kind of caused by the uncertainty that we're seeing at the federal level. So there's two bills that are active right now, House Bill 2408, which requires a silver qualified health plan on exchange in counties with no plans so people can access the Affordable Care Act subsidies. The other bill is House Bill 2355, which creates a reinsurance program on individual health markets that help spread the cost and risk and stabilizes the market. So we actually have two bills that are being actively worked on, and hopefully by the end of session that we will have something to try to address some of those concerns.
All right, thank you. We're going to go with Anne from Bellingham, who has a question about,
salmon
legislation. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. So I've been tracking the aquaculture industry for more than 20 years, so I so appreciate that there's momentum now that you're trying to, you know, change the tide of about 30 or 40 years of money coming into Washington to promote industrial aquaculture. The Department of Commerce, of which NOAA is two-thirds of the budget, they have expressed the goal of expanding U.S. marine aquaculture production by at least 50% by the year 2020. And apparently, according to some of my research, spent $100 million so far to promote ocean aquaculture. So that's why we've been a target, one of the two states in the country that has allowed salmon farming. So I know that it's hard to change this momentum. It's not the biggest spill that we had. There's been twice as many fish escape in the 90s. But, you know, our neighbors in D.C. know that diseases, you know, parasites, all sorts of diseases come out of these marine feedlots. So I want to caution you, too, that other big corporate interests, like, say, soy growers, are getting money to provide the feed for the aquaculture industry. So any kind of carnivorous species, halibut, black cod, you know, other species are going to bring the same problems in, diseases, parasites, pollution, you know, other things that if the money keeps coming into our state for marine feedlots, we're not going to be able to put the brakes on it in the future. So I really appreciate that you have legislation now. A lot of the money has been funneled to contract scientists and academics, so we don't want to go that route. Give them more money to stretch out the research. Thanks.
Yeah, I didn't hear a question in that, so I'll just respond. Our Ag and Natural Resource Committee is going to hear two more bills on Wednesday dealing with this exact issue. It's been a fascinating topic to follow. I know, you know, you sound like you know a lot about it, so there are a lot of legislators down here that are coming up to speed on that, on just how do we deal with farm fish in our state, how do we deal with our non-native fish that are being potentially introduced into our waters. So I think, you know, follow the process. I think people are all over the place with how we move forward, and I think you'll see a lot of the focus back on the Atlantic salmon and do we want to have Atlantic salmon, our, you know, they're non-native, they're invasive species being raised in Washington State. So I anticipate by the end of session that we may see a drastic change.
All right. We're going to go with Buzz, who has a question about the Hirsch position and the capital budget.
Hey, this is Buzz from Bellingham, and just a quick question about my understanding that the legislature had some mitigation from the Hirsch decision attached to the capital improvement budget. And I was wondering if you could expound on that and how that's going to affect us going forward in the future on rural wells, one way or the other. And I thank you for your hard work on that and all the other issues before you.
Yeah, Buzz, thanks for the question. This is Jeff Morris. I'll have to go back and double-check whether that mitigation money was in the capital budget we passed, because that was negotiated. The budget we passed was negotiated, last June. It was agreed to. And it could be what you're talking about might be in a supplemental budget. So I need to fact-check that. My office number is 360-786-7970, and if you can give me a ring in the morning, we can run that down. I can get that information back to you just to make sure I get my facts straight.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, now we're going to talk with Gretchen, who has a question about the carbon tax bill.
Hi there. I'm Gretchen Allison, and I live in the San Juan Islands. And I'm really happy to see finally some movement in carbon reduction legislation, and I would really like to see a carbon tax passed. And I'm a little worried that the legislation that's up by our fantastic Governor Jay Inslee is just a little bit weak and won't really have the impact that we really have got to do, that humanity has to do at this juncture in history. And I'd like to know if there's any way that you guys see where that bill could be improved. Is there a way to push it a little farther so we can get a little more reality out of it?
Thanks for the question. There's a plethora of many carbon reduction bills floating around the legislature right now, and a lot of them are good options. The carbon tax, I'll just put it this way. There's been a lot of research in British Columbia because they've they were an early adopter of a carbon tax over a decade ago now. And we've actually looked at what they've done very closely, and they've done a lot of research. The governor's proposal comes in at $20 a metric short ton, which is how they measure carbon. And what the research in BC, British Columbia, has shown is that until you get up to about $30 a metric short ton, you don't start seeing any changes in consumer behavior and trying to reduce your carbon footprint. So if you're really trying to get a carbon reduction policy in place, you probably would get that higher amount, about $30. If you're just trying to generate revenue and pave the way, maybe trying to get away from some of the rate shock might happen, you might come in at that $20. So as policymakers, that's what Chris and I are trying to figure out is, do you go right to the point where you can actually start reducing your carbon footprint? Or, do you have something where you provide a ramp up so that you can get the system in place and get it right? That's what kind of BC did. And we do have the data that British Columbia has done to draw upon. I don't have to recreate the wheel, but it's something we're trying to figure out if we can get the votes together to get passed. I'm just going to mention a couple other carbon bills. One of the bills, well, there's two bills I'm working on that aren't going to get a lot of attention because they're complicated to explain. And I'm not going to do it all in this teletown hall, but there's a bill for Puget Sound Energy, which is the largest utility in the state that provides electricity and natural gas in some areas. It doesn't cover the San Juan. That's Opelco. That's your utility there. But we're actually moving them to a zero carbon future, and we're changing their business model so they can start, instead of being paid how much electricity they sell you, there's going to be other ways they're going to have to get paid in order to reduce their carbon footprint and eventually get down to zero carbon in the electricity they sell you. And some of those things are going to be able to sell their customers electricity as a service for charging your car, for the certain amount of reliability, for achieving a certain amount of carbon reduction. And that's a bill that's complicated but will have a big impact if it passes. The other thing, I won't go into great detail. If you want to know more about this, please contact my office. But one of the really exciting things I'm working on is a bill. It's called Distributive Energy Resource Planning. That's trying to get more intra-distribution. So distribution system for electricity is what rolls down our street and up into our home. And as your neighbors put PV systems up, photovoltaic solar systems, or we buy electric cars, if we work to actually try to find the best place for those to go, so if you drive to a school to work or to a factory or a business, having community solar there where you can actually have production during the day of your cars parked all day is the most efficient, low-carbon footprint transaction possible. As opposed to shipping power up and down the West Coast, you get coal and natural gas plants involved. Anyway, it's fairly complex, but it's really going to have a big impact, too, if we can pass it. And those are just some examples of other good carbon ideas that now that we've got some agreement. And I just want to say, too, for the first time in my committee where I deal with a lot of this stuff, I've got four or five Republicans colleagues who are constructively putting their own ideas forth on carbon mitigation. Is a big step forward in the public dialogue happening here. So we're having a good discussion about how to get it right.
Yeah, and the governor has done some great work around the carbon bill and the carbon tax, and Senator Reuben Carlisle and Senator Guy Palumbo are kind of the leads on this, working with Representative Joe Fitzgibbon out of the House. That is a Senate bill that they're trying to get completed and see if they can get their 25 votes in order to get it out of the Senate. And then we anticipate it coming to the House, and we'll do the same thing.
Thank you. And we're going to go with an online question this time. It's from Drew, and let's see, he's saying that he's reading in the news that his property taxes are going up to pay for education. He thinks that property taxes are already high enough, and he would like you to come up with other revenue sources.
Yeah, so as I mentioned in the intro, I actually share the same concern. Last session, the Republicans really would only talk to us about property tax in order to pay for education, or that McCleary, as it's referred to, McCleary decision. And your property taxes are going up. You'll get your bills Valentine's Day, which is not a fun time to get that bill, but we do. I actually have a proposal out there. It's a proposal to swap out capital gains for property tax. So your property tax bill would go down about 55 cents per assessed value per thousand, and replace it with capital gains. What I have to do is figure out, if we reduce property taxes, we either have to cut services or we have to find another revenue source to do this. Capital gains is polls very, very popular. And what that is a tax on your interest earned from your sale of your stocks and bonds, over $50,000 per couple. It impacts about 48,000 people in our state. And as we know, property tax impacts everybody in our state, about 7 million taxpayers. So I share the same concerns, and I'm hoping that we can move forward with something to reduce property taxes across our state.
We are going to go with John, who has a question on affordable housing. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you very much for taking the call and for doing this. I'm on Orcas Island in San Juan County, and here, as well as all throughout the county, and I believe Bellingham and most places on the mainland, affordable housing is a significant issue for middle-class families. Finding housing that's available, affordable, and suitable is a huge issue. It has a social impact on the ability of parents to raise their kids in one thing and another. So I would like to know if you have anything besides just more subsidized government housing in the mill for solving this problem. Thank you.
Yeah, John, that's a good question. And I know in the Finance Committee, we actually have several bills dealing with housing. If you can, the same way as Jeff, if you can contact my office in the morning, I can get you the details of those. And, I don't have those right in front of me, quite frankly. We have hundreds of bills going through our committee right now, and I'm drawing a total blank on the bill number and the details of it. So contact my office, 360-786-7800.
And this is Jeff Morris. I'm just going to add that, you know, we've been working with the local housing authorities that, you know, trying to identify and get a little bit more money for pathways to home ownership as opposed to, situations where you're just renting a subsidized housing. You know, hopefully you want to create a staircase to get folks to actual ownership and stewardship. And there's been some really good examples both on Lopez and on Orcas Island of those programs. One of the things that Chris and I have heard about from some of the folks visiting with us the last couple of weeks is us doing some sort of set-aside for smaller counties and smaller housing authorities that sometimes don't have the volume to compete in some of the grant programs for those homeownership initiatives. So one thing we're going to work for going into next year is to see if we get a set-aside of like 10% for smaller counties to be able to qualify for some of those programs, so the money isn't always going to the big counties in the state.
Yeah, and one of the other bills has to deal with some of our land trusts that we have across our state that we are going to exempt the property tax while homes are being built for land trust to kind of give them a break to get those houses built, build more if they can, and not charge the property tax assessment until those homes are turnkeyed.
You are tuned to KMRE 102.3 FM and KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. We are going to go with Mary, who has a question about sewage treatment in Victoria. Hi, Mary.
Oh, okay. I'm concerned if we're using British Columbia as kind of as a guiding force, because I live right across from British Columbia, and I'm very concerned they still have no sewage treatment plant, which I think is horrible. And then the other thing is they have a ton of those salmon farms that are literally polluting. They're hurting our salmon, and they're hurting the native salmon all the way up the Salish Sea. And the other concern I have is what you just mentioned, too, about capital gains. That is a form of income tax. And that's really, I kind of think that's a back door to try to get to income tax. And, you know, we voted on this 11 times since I've lived I've lived here over 40 years, not on the island, but in Washington State. And we don't want an income tax.
Hi, this is Jeff Morris. I'm going to take the Victoria sewage call or question. So that's something I worked on the last few years, and it's something that actually when something, you get a chance to make a difference, it really makes serving this district in particular just such a joy to work on some of these projects. But, I've been tracking that issue literally for 20 years. Rob Johnson, who was a predecessor of Chris and I in the House back in the 90s, first started raising the issue of the raw sewage being dumped into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And, they proposed plans to do primary sewage treatment, again, primary sewage treatment, not secondary sewage treatment like our cities do, Anacortes and Port Angeles and so forth. It had an agreement with former Governor Lowry that was broken. There was just kind of a trail of commitments and then broken promises when they kind of backslid on moving towards construction. And so 3 years ago, I think it is now, some contacts I have were letting me know that they were backsliding again on the latest proposal to move forward with the construction of a sewage treatment plant. And I worked with Chris and some of my colleagues on the Appropriations Committee to get a budget proviso put in saying that no one who worked for the government in Washington could travel to Victoria until they had sewage treatment. And it really woke them up. Tourism Victoria, their government, all the regional cities around Victoria belong to a regional municipal authority, and their governor, who ironically is a Green Party member, her name's Lisa Helps, really stepped up and I think used the attention we were shining, the daylight we were putting onto that sewage problem, to push a proposal through. I'm so excited they actually just broke ground a few months ago with actual backhoes digging, treatment plant ponds. I put a picture on my Facebook and Twitter page if you want to see the actual machinery working, but they actually are constructing, cement's being poured, and hopefully, the literally millions of gallons of chemicals and raw sewage that were going to Rosario Strait will be treated by 2018 to 2019, and that will finally be just a sad chapter in our shared history of governance over the Salish Sea. I don't know, Chris, if you want to answer some of the other questions.
Yeah, so, Mary, I appreciate your concern about capital gains, but I'm going to push back a little bit that a capital gains is not an income tax. I know the voters in our state have voted that down at least three or four times, and so appreciate that, recognize that. I would not vote for an income tax here in the legislature. I think that is up to the voters to decide that. But a capital gains is not an income tax. And I think when I'm looking at tax fairness, and as I'm looking at how to help working families and middle-class families, I think we have to do what we can do to help out, you know, those people get their feet underneath them, reduce property taxes. And I think a capital gains is a legitimate proposal to bring forward as an excise tax. And anything that we work on down here, you know, we make sure that we have good legal advice before we move forward on anything, and a capital gains tax is not an income tax.
I'll just make a quick comment to you on the BC. You know, obviously, British Columbia is a different country. We often voice our concerns to them about our shared governance issues. We have a lot of groups where we do that on the government-to-government basis. Governor Inslee regularly has joint cabinet meetings with British Columbia, and I know those issues are brought up at the cabinet level with their ministers, their different ministries up there. Alaska's been a little bit more aggressive. I know Chris and I have talked a little bit about some of the things Alaska's done around reporting. You know, I know some people are calling them frankenfish when they're caught out salmon fishing for salmon in southeast Alaska. They've really been really aggressive about a reward program just to get some idea about the amount of escapement that's happening. I think Anne, who previously called them salmon feedlots, comparing them to cattle feedlots, which is what they are in the water, really brought up a good point that there's as the quality of the water degrades around those facilities and so forth, obviously we don't know what the long-term effects is going to be. And I know whether it's the food coloring that goes in the food or some of the antibiotic questions that we're struggling with how that's impacting our children long-term, that, you know, I know definitely whenever we're talking to British Columbia, we're saying, hey, you guys need to take another look at your aquaculture policy. I love fresh oysters and mussels from our local shellfish growers. I don't lump those in sometimes because they're not, feeding food in the water to shellfish when they grow them. They want the waters to be as pristine and clean as possible. So I think, for example, that's a great aquaculture partner when you look at the shellfish industry, but some of these other ones on an inland body of water just don't make sense.
Thank you. Jake, who has a question, and it's an online question, let's see, he says, what is happening with solar production?
Yeah, great question. Again, I won't try to be too long-winded on it, but, we started a fight back in 2013 to reauthorize our Washington State production tax credit. That it was passed late in the last special session, in June. It has become law. People are transferring over to the new program. What we're able to do is the old program was only going to touch about 80 megawatts of solar. With the new program, we're hoping it's going to touch about 165 megawatts of solar. And for folks, you know, what does that mean? Roughly every megawatt powers about 800 to 1,000 homes, depending on how much energy they consume. So you can tell that long term, that's going to be an awful lot of clean, renewable energy that we're going to have as part of our portfolio mix for electricity. It's really exciting. We've got a bill that cleans up a couple of the rough edges and transferring people from the old program to the new program. But we're really excited we're going to be able to touch so many new solar systems. And, you know, the price of solar electricity has dropped. I mean, I can't even begin to share with you how much it's dropped in the last 20 years. Right now we're seeing large centralized solar power coming in at around 2 to 3 cents for kilowatt hour installed, which is very competitive against natural gas and some of the other fossil fuels. Just like wind energy became competitive, we're seeing solar finally get down to a point where without any subsidies, it's starting to become cheaper than some of the fossil fuels. So it's been reauthorized. I've got another bill this year that's looking at community solar programs to let people that don't have good sun regimen access at your property. There's a lot of efficiencies with building a community solar facility versus putting them on individual rooftops, so you save some money. And we can put them in places where we need the electricity, like where people go for the day, like schools or office buildings, commercial strip malls, where their peak electricity use is when the sun and photovoltaic solar panels are producing the most energy. It's an exact supply and demand match. Again, that's the most efficient for both the, from a financial point of view, for rates, for cost to you and I, but it's also the lowest carbon footprint as well.
All right. Thank you. Well, that is all the time we have tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. And so now I'm going to hand it over to your lawmakers for closing remarks.
Yeah, this is Chris. I, you know, want to thank everybody who stayed with us and took our call and asked questions. I think this is a good connection for Jeff and I when we're down here. We don't get home much, and sometimes we feel a little bit disconnected from what's happening. I think for us it's important that there is a public process. Bills are heard and a lot of citizen input. Your emails are important. Your phone calls are important as we move forward. It's policy cutoff on Friday, so we're in a flurry of activity and working really long hours trying to figure out how to move forward. And while Jeff and I are both chairs of big committees, we also work on bills individually that impact our district, specifically the 40th Legislative District. So when we're home during the interim and even when we're down here, it's important for us to keep in contact with you so we know how to move forward, not just on big bills that affect the entire state out of our committees and, of course, in our caucuses, but then also how do we sponsor legislation that will be beneficial to the people we serve back home. And, again, it's an honor to serve you. I like working hard. I like the intensity of this job. And hopefully we can continue to do good things for people.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And I just want to say what a pleasure it is working with Chris down here and to have a great working relationship with my colleague representing the 40th District. You know, what's great about the 40th is you let us kind of work on serious issues that don't get a lot of political or newspaper headlines out there but are so important to our quality of life. They're a lot of times are complicated, so they don't fit into a nice headline on Twitter or Facebook or wherever those things you know tend to pop up these days. But it is important. I just want to take a second and close about, you know, because we get good communication about priorities from our district, we've really had an unprecedented investment, not only in the capital budget that just passed in infrastructure, all the schools that got funded. There was $3 million that went to the new Lopez High School construction, same amount of money that went to Mount Vernon and Sehome for new schools, because for this money we're putting in K-12 that Chris has been working for, you've got to have classrooms for those smaller classroom sizes to meet in. You're seeing a lot of the transportation money that we won the last couple of years land on the ground around the district. I mentioned the new trestle over Old 99, the new ferries coming into service, a new one which is christened last week. That's the third out of four that are being built to give more reliable service to our ferry customers. I know it's controversial, but the big roundabout project out at Sharps Corner and Anacortes is going to be a major safety upgrade. That was going to happen over 2 years. It's now going to be done in one construction season to lessen the interruption to folks' lives going to and from Anacortes. All those things that came from the transportation package we did a couple of years ago. So it's been a good investment in infrastructure. You know, the good broadband access, reliable, clean electricity, quality transportation services. Those are all things that make our area so special to live in. And, you know, touching base with you like this is so critical. The idea that I think it was Buzz or from Bellingham talked about using the Bellingham Ferry Terminal as a backup terminal for what happened in Anacortes the other day. It's just a little nugget we get from these calls. It's going to become action tomorrow. So thank you for spending some time with us tonight.
You are tuned to KMRE 102.3 FM and KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt. This is Cascadia News Now, and I'm Stephanie Contouris. The Let's Talk workshop and event on race and racism is coming up February 11th at the Unitarian Church, and tickets are almost sold out. We had a chance to speak with Jerry Ibalarosa-Tanel, who is one of the leaders of the workshop this week.
The Let's Talk is Stretching Our Edges on Race and Privilege is going to be a workshop that we're going to be holding at the Bellingham Unitarian Fellowship Church on Sunday, February 11th from 2 to 4:30. And so basically what it is gathering people together to engage in deep, transformative dialogue about race and privilege.
And why is it important now in today's environment?
Well, if we look at what's happening in our society right now, especially with in our current administration, there's been a lot of racial slurs and things towards the minority communities. And me as a woman of color have experienced that firsthand. And so I think it's really important right now to be able to talk about it in a way where we would engage in deep listening and not in a place where it's divided. And right now, it's like I'm seeing that our world is so divided right now because of race and privilege. And for me, I believe that it's because people don't really know how to talk about it, and that when we stretch our edges on it, it can be very, very uncomfortable. And so I'm hoping that with Let's Talk, we'll be able to engage in dialogue by sharing stories for myself and also my co-lead, Ashanti Monstravesca, who's going to be talking about what we've experienced in this time frame in this past year or so.
Jerry, who do you want to come to this event?
I would want everyone to come, because it's all of our responsibilities to check our privileges. We've got to be able to talk about this and talk about it to where we can build community and build communication and go deeper into what causes all of this, what causes this race and white supremacy and, you know, just being uncomfortable with intersectionality.
And this seems like it could be an event for women, but you're saying that you want everybody to come. So is gender open as well?
Yeah, absolutely. This isn't an event for just women. This is an event for everyone who is seeking some kind of transformation and who is seeking just knowledge and skills to be able to hold dialogue in regards to race and privilege. Everyone that is all interested should come, especially white people. I'm just going to put it out there,
yep.
Especially white people, because right now it's like the way, you know, what we're seeing right now is with Black Lives Matter, with intersectionality, with gender inequality, with all of this that's going on, all of these injustices that's going on, a lot of times it boils down to the privileges that we have. And although white people may not want to agree with this, that it has to do with race. And how can we talk about that? How can we talk about race? And how can we check our own privileges so that way we don't overpower anybody else?
I think you hit on a good point. A lot of movements and a lot of groups right now are being led by people of color and women of color for the first time, and that's great. But I think sometimes white people feel that they don't belong in those movements and therefore don't support them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, I feel that when people of color rise up, we want to be able to, if we didn't feel safe in a space, we would be able to tell you. We would tell you, you know what, we don't feel safe. But when people of color rise up and we are inviting everyone to come in, then it goes beyond the color of our skin. It really comes to how we're going to be existing in this world and how are we going to actually change the way humanity sees each other, how we see each other, how we navigate and how we actually co-create together. And so this is an invitation from two women of color. Ashanti Monstravesca is actually, she's African American, she's female, she's deaf. And so she has a lot of intersections. And so it's like, I want people to be able to come in and listen to her talk and listen to her share her stories. And, you know, for us people who can hear and who can speak, that's our privilege. And we've got to check our privilege, because whenever we don't allow space for Ashanti to be heard, then we're actually putting that into the shadows of humanity. And with everything else, when we're uncomfortable with it, let's just like put it on the side and not talk about it. This is the opportunity to actually constructively have a discussion about things that separate us, to kind of like come together and start talking about it.
I'm really glad that you took a little bit of time to tell us about Ashanti. Tell me who you are and how do you come to this work?
I'm Jerry Ballarosa-Tanell, and I actually came into this work because of who I am and what I've experienced. I have the privilege of having higher education and first-generation higher education in my family. I was born and raised in Hawaii. I lived here in Washington State since 1983. I've experienced racism on so many different levels. I experienced gender inequality. I actually was bullied out of an organization that was actually for anti-bullying because of the way that I spoke. And I lost the way that I spoke according to my people in Hawaii because I assimilated to a culture that I felt was what dominated over me. And when I did that, I oppressed my own people. I oppressed the people of Hawaii because I was embarrassed about the way I talked. I was embarrassed about who I was. And so I tried to make myself. I wore this veil of oppression that I didn't even know that I was wearing until someone pointed it out to me. And I come into this work with a lot of empathy and a lot of compassion because I know what it's like to walk between two worlds, between the world of Western philosophy and indigenous ways of knowing.
It takes such an amazing amount of courage and vulnerability to say what you just said.
It does, but I never could say it before. I never could say it before, you know? It was like I never felt that I had the liberty to actually say what I'm saying. But I appear to everyone as, you know, just who I am. I've learned to come to the table and to bring everything that I have of authenticity. And, you know, it's like, I know the struggles. I know how difficult it can be when we're challenged. And so that's why it's so important with this seminar, with this workshop on Let's Talk, on coming to the table and really, really stretching our edges. And it's not going to be a place where we're going to shame anyone because of their racist acts or, you know, utilizing the privilege in a wrong way. We just want to bring it to light and say, hey, you know what? This is what you've got. So how can we work together? Because I know even till today, my white sister out there who has more privilege than me, and instead of her looking at me to say, hey, you know what, can you help me? I can turn around and say, you know what, can you help me? How are you going to utilize your privilege to help me? This is a great opportunity to figure out how we can actually work together.
I think it will be incredibly inspiring just to hear you, Jerry, and hear Ashanti, but it's a workshop, not a panel and not a speech. So what else is going to happen?
Well, we're going to push the boundaries. We're going to push the status quo. And so, you know, it's like Ashanti and I are going to share our stories and everything like that on how we've experienced race and privilege in our world through our lenses. And then we're going to do exercises on race and privilege with you know, all of the attendees, on asking them different questions and really pushing the boundaries, which we're kind of excited to do. And so definitely there's going to be all kinds of questions in regards to sexuality, privilege, ability, gender, sex, race privilege, religious privilege, class, nationality. We're going to be bringing it all out. We're going to be bringing it all, you know, into this 2 hours, 3 hours of this workshop, and really hoping that people walk away recognizing and noticing who they are and how they navigate in the world. Because once you know, you cannot unknow unless you choose to. And so that's what we're hoping, is like bringing light to things. Because sometimes people are not even aware of their privilege, their biases, and, you know, their microaggressions. Sometimes we're not even aware of it until someone points it out to us. And so we're hoping that we can bring people to the place where everyone's going to feel a little bit raw in the end, but healing begins once we can acknowledge the fact that this is who we are.
Jerry, I want to ask you, let's say there's a listener in the audience who's, say, a white woman who says, I have been through so many diversity workshops. I don't want another diversity workshop. I just want to act. How would you respond to that?
They just want to act because mm-hmm. they've been to a lot of diversity workshops. Then you know what? The acting continues. This workshop is a little bit different because we have someone who is deaf that is going to be in the audience. And I've seen it before. I've done work. Ashanti and I are actually colleagues at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And I've seen where she and I could be having a conversation and someone else would be talking to me because they can hear and they can speak for me to speak for them, to speak to Ashanti. And it's like, you know what? She's right here. She has an interpreter. Why don't you go ahead and speak to her? And it's a challenge. It's a challenge. And I haven't seen any diversity workshop that would bring such an element, such power to this, like Ashanti can bring to this event.
So
I think with that person, if they're calling in saying, what can they do and how can they act? It's like, a lot of times we have a lot of people who are want to go ahead and act because they've been through a lot of different diversity conferences and everything like that. I'd like to challenge them a little more. Have they really acted in all ways where things are inclusive, which is really difficult. And, you know, I mean, I don't think everybody has really faced every single injustice out there.
The work is ongoing.
The work is ongoing, for sure.
So I have to ask you, I'm asking a lot of people this question. In our current situation with our federal administration, everything that's happening right now, is hope possible?
I think hope is something that the individual has to have. You know, it's like, you know, I always go back to the quote of Krishnamurti that the only hope for humankind is a transformation of the individual. And when an individual can transform, then I believe there's hope. But that's the only way that it can happen is if it's in the transformation of the individual.
What are the other things that you want our listeners to know or think about?
I would ask the listeners out there to come with an open mind and with an open heart and to be ready to learn and to engage. And if at any time they feel that they know more than anybody else, to put that on the side and to just open up for more learning, because it's an ongoing process.
I know tickets are going fast for this event.
Very fast, very fast. In fact, if right now, just looking at what we have, we only have a few more tickets. So I would really highly recommend everyone to actually get online and purchase them today if they can.
Thank you again for taking the time to speak with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Jerry Ibalarosa-Tonell, who with Ashanti Mons Treviska will be sharing their stories about race and racism at Let's Talk, Sunday, February 11th in Bellingham. If you'd like to know more about that event or anything else that we talk about, check us out on Facebook, Cascadia News Now. If you'd like to hear our current show or our past shows, or if you'd like to give us feedback, you can go to CascadiaNewsNow.com. I'm Stephanie Contouris, Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and I will be back next week. Thanks for listening to Cascadia News Now.